Hello and welcome to Mito Action's evening roundtable discussion with Dr. Daniel Nail. Tonight, Dr. Daniel Nail will discuss the pediatric role in the growing up years. My name is Stephanie Harry. I am an LCHAD parent and one of the patient support coordinators here at Mito Action and will be your host for this evening. Tonight's discussion will be recorded and available on Mito Action's website in the coming days. We'll be recorded and available in the coming days. This space is a little different than our traditional expert series, which is why my momentary blip of trying to remember what I'm supposed to say. We set this call up as a Zoom meeting instead of a webinar, which means that you have both video and audio access. So please take this time to make sure that you're muted and that your video is either on or off, depending on your preference. But it's very important that you keep your audio off while you're not speaking. This will help give everyone a more pleasurable experience. If you have questions during Dr. Nail's presentation, feel free to put them in the chat and I can ask them after the presentation. Or if you'd like to ask your own question, simply raise your virtual hand or your actual hand and you can unmute yourself and ask your question yourself. Although this session is recorded, after our recorded Q&A, we like to also pause the recording and give families a chance to ask questions that are not being recorded to protect your privacy. So during the presentation, just think about whether or not you want to ask your questions before or after that time. So without further ado, let me officially introduce Dr. Daniel Nail. Dr. Daniel Nail has been in practice since 1981. He did his residency in pediatric medicine at the University of Michigan. He's been selected numerous times as one of the best pediatricians in Dallas by D Magazines. Professional associations include Dallas County Medical Society, Pediatric Society of Greater Dallas, Christian Medical Association, and American College of Pediatricians. He has a lifelong commitment to improving the lives of children and their families in the Dallas metro area. And we are so excited for him to share his experiences. And we're very, very grateful for all of his hard work in the rare disease community. And I'm very grateful also to Alex Salser for introducing us and helping to bring him on tonight for this very important presentation. So thank you.
Thanks.
So,
So I
can
think
you look? Yeah, this is the time for you to share your screen.
we got it.
You're good to go.
Okay. Well, I'm grateful to be here too. Great. I guess I'm grateful to Alex to invite me here. Certainly, Alex introduced me to what it means to be a pediatrician of a child with fatty acid oxidation disorders. One of the questions was, yeah, how did I get into this? And it's probably the same way her parents did. They found out that they had a child in their home that needed attention who had LCHAD, and I all of a sudden realized I had a patient with that. And so both of us, both parents and myself, had to learn about what that means. And I think that's what every parent who is introduced to a special needs child or a particular rare disease or just some challenge, that we all have to get educated. Pediatricians, like any physician, will come into general practice, and we know a little bit about a lot of things. That's kind of the part of the pediatrician, is that we have to study every single organ system, all the diseases, and we may have gone over some of these types of diseases sometime in medical school or in training, but we wouldn't be well versed in it. So we have to go back and catch up. We have to go back and reread things. Plus, medicine changes so quickly that even if we did know it and we went to medical school 10 years ago, a lot of things may have changed. So it really does require, I think, pediatricians to get up to speed with when they have children with newer things or things that they just haven't seen. And these are rare diseases, and I'm probably one of the few pediatricians in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that has a moderate degree of experience with LCHAD, and also I have a patient with MCHAD. So I am I've gotten the privilege of being part of this community for a while. The other thing I guess parents are going to realize that they is that they need support from a lot of different ways, that they will need support from family members sometimes. They will need possibly some emotional support because it's a very it can be very challenging. They will need so not only education, but they'll need support from other areas. A community I was not familiar with Mito Action until just a few weeks ago when I was asked about doing this program. So these kind of things I think are really valuable resources for parents to get educated, sometimes connect with other community, other experts. The fact that you have some of these videos in your library, I think is just amazing. So yeah, I'm really impressed with this program and what you guys are doing. So yeah, I'm glad for the opportunity. The next question that was asked was about communication, and I talked about listening. Both, well, communication is always a two-way street, both for the pediatrician to the patient and the patient or the parent to the pediatrician. And with special needs children, it can get more complicated just because it's a more complicated disease. So how do we do this? How do we do this well? I think it takes good listening, obviously. It's just like any relationship that we have to listen well, try to understand where the patient and the parent is coming from. So trying to look for cues that your pediatrician is actually hearing what you're trying to communicate. And it's important for us as pediatricians to understand well. Asking good questions is kind of key to that. One of the cues I think to good communication can be to, particularly as you get to the end of some phase, either from the visit or a particular problem, is to reiterate if you ask if you do if they understand what I've just tried to communicate, or restate it and say, do I have that right? So that because with complex diseases, the instructions or the information can be very critical, and if we don't hear it well or we don't communicate it well, it can that's a significant source sometimes for frustration for parents and for physicians when we don't communicate well. And yeah, we all do that. We're just human beings. One thing to know too is when you come into a pediatrician's office, you'll often have at least two, if not more, opportunities to communicate. And knowing what the how the logistics of the particular office is can be important. So, for instance, when you come in, you'll check in, identify your child. You'll go back to, usually to a room, and you'll often be interact with a medical assistant who might do vital signs, weight measure, those kind of things, blood pressure, temperature. And then they'll often ask you, why you're there, what the problem is. And I would make those kind of that particular action or that particular interaction to be pretty short and pretty bullet point, because you don't really want to explain the entire problem to the medical assistant. They really don't need to know that because save that for the physician to really explain what your understanding of the problem is. So my child has been sick for 3 days. They had a temperature up to 102. We've been giving them Tylenol. Their appetite is not good. Those kind of bullet point information to get a succinct information about what the major problem is. In the back of your mind, you might have one or two other problems that you would really like to discuss. And so when you may put those, give those to medical assistant, or at least when the physician comes into the room, I think it helps us to, especially to say, well, I've got three problems here. One might be an acute problem, an illness, but I also have some questions about my medications and maybe one other thing that you're concerned about. So you're giving the physician some cues of how much time this might take.
Dr.
You
Neal, I
might.
hate to interrupt you. I just wanted to let you know
Absolutely.
that your slideshow's not, I think you meant to maybe forward it.
Oh,
So you're
you're
just going
right.
to have to forward it.
There you go. Okay, we're already
Okay.
on the second point. So yeah, time constraints are knowing how much time you have. Ideally, you do that when you actually make your appointment. You can ask the office how long do you usually give for an appointment. So an acute illness appointment may only be 10 minutes. If you know you're going to need more than that, you can ask, is it possible to get a little bit longer appointment? Is there or another time available? And that does, kind of help because if you have, 20 minutes worth of, if you're hoping to get 20 minutes and on the doctor's schedule, he has 10, there's going to be some difficulty because, the doctor's already looking at his schedule and he's already got, four more patients to see in the next, 30, 40 minutes. And you really want to keep going on with the next three problems. That's going to be a little bit of a time constraint. We often expect that those kind of things happen, but it does create issues sometimes with offices because other patients will get frustrated because they're waiting long. The office staff will try to figure out how they handle other patients. So being aware of the time constraints within an office are quite important. If you find something like the only thing that's going to work is a 10-minute visit, but you really have other things, then you're probably going to pick the top one or two problems and try to get through those and then say, ask, okay, when can we schedule another time? Or are these particular questions that are less urgent? Could I give those to the nurse to go and maybe she could answer them or she could go over with those questions with the doctor later on. So we want to address all of your questions. We really do. But time is usually one of the limiting factors on those kind of things. Let's see. What kind of things can you lean on for your pediatrician? Hopefully you can lean on them for some degree of oversight in terms of the big picture of what's going on with your child. So yeah, if they, for instance, they have LCHAD and they have say two or three or more specialists that they also see for the particular problems that they have to deal with. We have some responsibility to try to keep up with what the other specialists are doing, what they're recommending, what medications they're changing. We can try to do that, but it really helps when the parents are very much involved in that process. So, like when you go to a specialist, take notes yourself, ask for the notes that the physician records in their either electronic record or whether they're or hand notes, whatever they do, you can ask for notes either at the time of the visit, but sometimes it might be several days, later before they're even available. But try to get a copy for yourself and a copy for the pediatrician the next time you go, or you can send them electronically or fax them to the office so that the physician, the pediatrician, has a fairly complete record of what's going on with your child. That's very helpful. Some specialists are not very good at providing those, and that's frustrating for us as pediatricians. But I think parents can be very helpful when they ask for those kind of records and then keep up with them. Having a problem list, I think pediatricians and parents should have some idea, either mentally or on your phone or somewhere, what are the major things that we're dealing with? From the disease standpoint, so for instance, if it's LCHAD, do we see a cardiologist? Do we see an ophthalmologist? Do we see a neurologist? Do we see orthopedics? Do we see this specialist at the medical center who oversees metabolic things? All of those things we have to kind of keep in mind. And particularly at their yearly visits, we want to kind of touch on just about all of those things if possible. And do I have recent records? If you just saw them 2 months ago, I will try to look and see, well, what did the cardiologist say, or what did they recommend, or at least do I have a record so I can go back and look at it later? So those are very important things for us to have a kind of a global picture on that. And also to coordinate the care. Sometimes we'll find that we might send a child to a specialist, and this is actually a frequent occurrence, which is frustrating for the parents and for us. So, for instance, we want to have them seen by a cardiologist, but if the cardiologist has never seen an LCHAD kid before or anything even close to it, can they get up to speed with it, or do we need to find another cardiologist who maybe has more experience? Sometimes it's important, sometimes it's not. I know one of the things that we had to deal with was with ophthalmology. No, hardly. I don't think anybody in Dallas had seen retinas of an LCHAD kid ever. And they were all pretty impressed with it, and sharing, telling their colleagues. But we really needed not just the fact their interest in it, but what are they seeing? What does this mean? How do we interpret this? And if they really don't have any experience or with this, then perhaps we need to widen the circle and find some other specialist in possibly another city, another state sometimes. Which is what we did with Alex and I. We searched for someone who had more expertise for that particular problem, because that was an issue that was relevant to us. Like for cardiology, if we weren't really having any problems and everything was stable, then it's certainly more convenient to use a local cardiologist who's a pediatric cardiologist and can at least document that things are stable and are doing okay. So sometimes it depends on the problem. Sometimes it depends on the particular specialist and how much expertise they have or lack of for this particular problem. How is it going? So if you're going to the specialist, are you getting good directions, or do things seem to be working? Is the interaction, is that going well? So all of those things are relevant to each of those points. Coordination of care has to do with sometimes just the mechanics in LCHAD kids, particularly when they're very young, with even minor illnesses. We often needed some urgent attention at the emergency room or hospitalization, which required a number of things. Either the pediatrician, or preferably we had letters that went to that could be given to the emergency room to say, this is a diagnosis that requires quick attention. We need to get an IV into this child fairly quickly, and she's not to sit in the waiting room for an hour like everybody else, unfortunately. How well is that working? And the same thing on the floor in the hospital, do they seem to have a pretty good appreciation for what's going on? Sometimes it takes a little bit of education. Sometimes it takes some trial and error. Occasionally, if we just can't get the coordination and get things going, we have to find it. Possibly a different institution to work with to see if we can get the things that we need. So ED, hospital, all of those things are going to be relevant to, and sometimes we as pediatricians are able to contact the people who are in charge. So sometimes it's the administration of the hospital. So what can we do to facilitate the care of this child for this particular problem, because it's a big problem. And I do that for a number of children. I just had a conference, a week ago with a one of the liaisons from Children's Medical Center here in Dallas, because on the weekends we couldn't get a simple blood test done for a particular situation. And even though we had been promised that this was going to happen and this is how we do it, when I was on call 2 weeks ago and that exact situation came up and it was on a Sunday morning and I had to get a blood test, it was a real chore because it hadn't been adequately communicated to the people who were sitting at the front desk where the patients come into the facility. So just those kind of coordinations of care things and logistics, and they're frustrating for parents and they're frustrating for us. So even when we try our best to make sure everything works well, it doesn't always. But let us know so that we can try to keep trying as well. All right. When do you use pediatricians versus specialists in the care of your child? How do they collaborate? Specialists are going to be for usually the specific organ systems that might be involved. So with LCHAD kids, we often need a cardiologist involved. Sometimes well, you're going to need preferably some metabolic people. That sometimes is a challenge based on your location. So you might be an hour or two away from, a good metabolic specialist. Or sometimes what happened with us, we ended up reaching the limits, it seemed like, of the expertise of some of the local people. So we ended up going to Pittsburgh for some more specialized treatment and to get on the protocol for some of the other medications that Alex needed. So we constantly are trying to find out what is the best fit for this particular child, and can this particular specialist, help us with the problem? And so that's what we do. So I do the general care, the day-to-day stuff, the minor illnesses, and often the hospitalizations that are hopefully short term, but sometimes they aren't. I mean, sometimes, particularly when children are young, even relatively minor viruses can result in a 2 week stay in a hospital. And so it requires some patience on everybody's part to achieve it. Well, and I guess the pluses and minuses are just what we just said, in the sense that we all have limitations on what we do and what we do well. And when we find that a particular specialist or even a generalist, it's a little bit outside of their expertise, or we just can't get something done, then sometimes we don't like to fire people, but sometimes we have to seek other care. And yeah, don't feel free to ask. Pediatrician, how did the process go? I can't read what we said there. Oh, a team of doctors. That's pretty much what we were just talking about. But the other aspect of the team of doctors is, so if you have a single pediatrician, primary care doctor, who does that person, who do they share call with? Who is on their particular team? Because physicians are human too, and we sometimes need a day off or a weekend off or something like that. So we generally can't physically be available 24/7, 365. So part of the process is trying to figure out, well, who's available when they're not available? And are they up to speed, or can they get hold of the other doctor who does know more? Those kind of things, because you don't want to be in a position where you're going in for something and they don't even know who you are, what your problem is, or and even what that means. So trying to identify the different layers of physicians, from generalists to specialists, but then who else is on their team, if they're not available. Where is kind of what we just talked about. Ideally, if we can get most of our specialists locally, that's helpful. But sometimes we have to go beyond local and find someone else if we need to. Implementing a plan. My role as a provider is just that overall care, trying to coordinate, get the information from the specialists, and make sure that we have the same. Are on the same page and what the major problems are. Do we have the same list of medications? Are we up to date on which medications they're on and what the dosages are? And that's an important thing for the parents. If you can be prepared when you come into each visit with a physician, is you've already gone through in your head, or ideally even just written it down or put it on your phone. These are the things that we kind of need to talk to, or this is my medication list. And oh, by the way, the specialist just changed the dose on a medication. So the pediatrician kind of knows that, because it can be very relevant. Say I had to put the child in the hospital. I'm going to go buy the medication list that's listed there. And if we haven't updated it, we might give the incorrect dose. So, yeah, all that is just part of that communication that we have to be very diligent with. And it does require both patients and physicians to be constantly diligent for these kids, because they're complex. We love them, but they're not easy sometimes, as you parents know. Availability and backup. I think it's pretty much what I just said, is that who else is available, when your primary care doc or your specialists are not available? Is there someone else available? And then, keep trying. Don't give up. Try to work with the team that you have as best you can. One of the things that can be challenging for both parents and physicians is how much of this is primarily just a particular illness, and how much of it is the metabolic effect of the illness. And honestly, I think I had to learn to rely on the parents and the patient, particularly as I got older, to express how they felt. For Alex, some of it was just sort of feeling a little bit of a mental fog that happened, with illness, and the metabolic effects of that, that she was not able to do schoolwork sometimes, just because of it. It was just going to require sometimes a longer hospitalization until metabolically things were more stable. So again, it goes back to that communication and being honest, and us listening, and realizing that these are complex kids, and we don't always know exactly the best way how to do it, but we'll try. Practical tips. I think we said this already, stating the goals. Both at the visits, each time you come in, what would I like to accomplish? Write it down, and then even keeping track of, well, what did we talk about? Sometimes I will write things down for the patients. Okay, I want you to do this and this and this. Or if you can keep a record of, what did the doctor say? Because it's particularly with these complex children, we might have gone over five different things, And we made a few changes. And when we don't write them down, we're like, we walk away and say, oh my goodness, what did he say about this? I'm not quite sure. So yeah, it really helps to keep records and to keep everything current. What are my goals? And these can be different for different patients and different parents and even for different physicians, but we want to communicate our goals. I mean, if the parent's like, I want my child to have a normal, as normal a childhood as possible in terms of school, in terms of sports, in terms of activities and things like that. If I know that that's an important goal for the parents, then, that's going to be an important thing, on my mental list to say, okay, how do we achieve some of these things? That might require some physical therapists or maybe some extra care in different areas. But it's important, for us to know the parents' desires and the patient's desires in terms of what do they want. And we're trying to help you achieve those goals if we can. I think we talked about availability, and who their backup is. Occasionally when things don't go well, can you discuss it? And that's again, that's just human to human interaction in terms of, I mean, all of us who are married realize that we don't always agree with everything that someone else says. And so how do we get through that? How do we talk through that, either difference of opinion, or how do we get to some consensus on it? And that can happen even with patients and physicians. But I think the more honestly that we communicate, the better off that we can be. Learning to trust each other and being open and honest with what our goals are. How do you know if it's a good fit? I guess I would just say, all of the above that we just talked about is kind of going to tell you if it's a good fit. The thing about listening and communicating, the things about, how does the office run? Is it consistent? Do we have good backup? Are we meeting the goals? And are we on a generally good course? I mean, sometimes it's frustrating because we don't necessarily know. I know some of the kids, when they go to through certain times of life, so adolescence and puberty and things like that, things can get thrown off, and they can be challenging to get through. But yeah, the secret I think is not to jump ship because we're not having a good time. Are we maximizing the resources that we have, and we're just going to have to weather this time? Or do we keep looking for outside help? Yes. But sometimes there may not be perfect answers for all of the problems that we have. We certainly met some of those situations along the road, and we just had to kind of weather the storm. And pray a lot, I guess, because it is a challenge. I think we got everything, and hopefully within a time frame that fits everybody. So I'm open to questions if any of that was not clear, or you had, I can try to clarify.
So, Dr. Neal, if you want to unshare your screen, we'll go to kind of the full picture. And if people have questions, I see Megan already has her hand raised. I've had a couple come through my phone and stuff too. So we'll ask this, but we'll let Megan go first with her question. Go ahead, Megan, or your husband, but Megan's
Yeah,
name is up there.
it's me, it's Zach. Dr. Neil, thanks for being here. Obviously appreciate you doing that, because these videos help us as a family. We've gone through some of the other videos, so even in the future, it can help other people. Two questions that I have is, one, we have our son Roman, who's 3 months old,
So luckily, we have had no incidents yet of any kind. Knock on wood, we've been very fortunate. But one of the things as a parent is that we look towards in the future is what dictates the length of a hospital stay. I guess we're still trying to understand and wrap our brain around the what ifs could happen. And I know it's different. I know every child's different. Every situation's different. We get that. But hypothetically, zoomed out, some of the factors that change the length of a hospital stay.
It really is pretty much dependent on the particular illness and the child and how they respond to it. What you'll probably experience is it, does your child have LCHAD too, or
Chad,
LCHAD?
correct.
Okay. The first few months oftentimes are not too difficult, except for the frequent feedings and the diet and those kind of things.
Now that's it.
The challenge will be, though, once they start interacting with other humans, is you start getting illnesses, and that typically has a significant effect. And because their appetite is often suppressed significantly, and then you're in the hospital. A lot of it just really depends on the child's response to the illness. Even if it's just, say, a common cold, sometimes they only feel bad for a couple of days, and then their appetite may start to return. And so we can start turning down the IV. And if as their appetite increases, we can just sort of taper it one way or another. There was, although I think Alex was, I forgot what age. She was older. She was an infant. Most of her hospitalizations early on were a few days to a week, I think. And then we had a experience with something called adenovirus, which is a relatively common virus, and it can be a challenge. For Alex, it was a real big challenge, and it resulted in, I think, 17 days. I mean, a common virus, and it just kicked her tail, as it does sometimes. Even people without LCHAD, you can just, like, mono, for instance, is another bad one. Unfortunately, she didn't do that, but you can just feel rotten for a really long time. And if it just makes you not want to eat, obviously for LCHAD kids, that's a big deal. And so you're sometimes on a much longer hospitalization. So we're responding. We'll challenge them a little bit by, okay, we're going to turn down the IV a little bit, see how that goes. If it doesn't go well, we might turn it back up. We had many, many ups and downs to try to figure out, when is the proper time. So for myself, I never had a target. It was like, until the kid, it wasn't like, okay, we're going to be in for 3 days. It was like, it's kind of when you feel better and your appetite is back to where it kind of needs to be. So I know that's kind of a nebulous answer, but it's going to vary, because different illnesses are going to challenge them more or less, and some require longer or shorter hospitalizations.
That makes sense. And Stephanie, I have a second one, but I don't know if you want to go to somebody else first or.
No, I think I just wanted to comment. Oh, and Shrika has a question. So yeah, maybe we'll skip to her and then come back to you guys. But I think Dr. Nail brought up a good point, like with LCHAD and some other rare diseases and mitochondrial disease, 2 + 2 doesn't always equal 4. And so that can be a huge part of the equation. It's frustrating, like, a common cold might end up creating more havoc than even a stomach bug. And you expect the stomach bug to be the issue, but then it ends up being the cold or stress from school. And I was curious, kind of, when you guys were asked about how long you'd say, like, Dr. Neal, what has been your experience? Like, if you feel like, if a patient feels like they need a couple extra days or aren't quite ready, but the hospitalist is like, no, you're fine, and wants to push them out, like, how do you, as a pediatrician, help the families navigate that? Have you had experience with that?
If you put more fingers in the pie, it often gets messier. For Alex, most of the time I was the attending in the hospital, so I didn't have to deal with the hospital as an intermediary most of the time, and that, I think, just makes it simpler, because I knew her better. And most of the hospitalists were pretty glad that I actually took it on myself to do it. So it just it kind of depends on your situation. And and if you have a relationship, you know, with the physician, it's always going to go better. I mean, a hospitalist who doesn't know you from Adam, who's never seen an LCHAD kid in their life, you know, they're like, you know, why are you still in here? You need to be, you know, you need to be out of here. And the kid still feels rotten. And they're not going to do well at home. And so it can be a challenge. So yeah, ideally you work out those relationships as best you can. Or so if there is a hospitalist, hopefully your pediatrician, you know, can communicate well with the hospitalist to either instruct them or give them guidance on, you know, what some of the protocols are for these kids.
So it sounds like it's a reasonable request for us. Often it was our metabolic specialist, but for our metabolic specialist or for our pediatrician to be in contact with the hospitalist, if you don't have like the luxury of your hospitalist being also your pediatrician, I wish that would have been an amazing experience for us. But it sounds like you're saying it's reasonable to ask the hospitalist to talk, please talk with my pediatrician, or, and here's their information. Please talk with my metabolic specialist. Here's their information, or geneticist.
Absolutely. Either ask them to call them, or you can ask your pediatrician to call them. They'll usually, they may or may not respond as well to you, which unfortunately, but usually if they're like, if the secretary says, "Oh, Dr. Nail's on the line for you," they usually take those kind of calls. Or, you know, it's like, yeah, or call me back, you know, today sometime, you know, so that we can go over the plan. Yeah, it's reasonable. It should be reasonable. If it's not, then yeah, you've got some problems and you may have to look for better resources.
Sharika, I see your hand raised.
Hey, yes, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Neil, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, there.
I have two kiddos. I have one eight, well, actually nine. He just turned nine this week, with VLCAD, and a 1-year-old with VLCAD. And my question is, how do you see, from the patient or parent perspective, me intentionally engaging and pulling my pediatrician in more in our care? Because we typically, whether it's hospitalizations or just run-of-the-mill questions, we lean on our metabolic team a lot. But I do know that, is that my phone? What is that? I do know that our pediatrician, who we got from Stephanie, thank you so much, she does have experience, right? She worked with Christopher for years and years, so she's experienced enough that I probably could lean on her more, but just our go-to has just been the metabolic team. I mean, the 9-year-old has been, he's probably been hospitalized 15 times. I mean, that first year was really, really rough. And so we just have leaned into them more. But I feel like, you know, with this second round, maybe we should be or could be leaning into our pediatrician more and including her more in the care. And we just haven't done that. And I'm kind of nervous to do so and don't even really know how to go about that.
I think just a straight up question to and the next time you go into the pediatrician, express almost exactly what you just said. It's like in the past we've relied on the metabolic specialist. Do you feel like your knowledge base and your team, you know, the people who are with you know, could we do more of this, you know, in-house locally or whatever it is, however you would do it? I think just asking the question to see if they feel like they're up to speed to doing all those things, so, you know, and ask them those. You know, you have a wealth of experience, which is valuable to the pediatrician, and you could probably, you know, bullet point these are some of the things that we had to go through. And that we got instructions and how the protocols with the specialist in the past. So you say, yeah, these are some of the things that we experienced. Do you think that's possible to do that less with them and more with you? And yeah, hopefully they're honest enough to say, whew, yeah, that might be above our pay grade, or like, yeah, we're all in. So I think just, you know, communicating that kind of as you did here.
Okay, and Stephanie, one quick follow-up question. It's really related to this one. Dr. Neil, do you have, because so with our practice, obviously it's there are other doctors too, so we don't always get our pediatrician who has the experience with FAODs. Is there a packet or these binders that we send to the school and to other people, should we be providing them with something so that if we're in crisis, something happens and our pediatrician who is well-versed is not available, that the other doctors in the team can kind of quickly look at this binder and, or how should we be equipping them for those times when our doctor is not available?
Yeah, I mean, yes, to all of those things. If you either have some, ideally, your primary pediatrician can communicate, okay, here's, here's a child that's going to require more specialized care.
Right.
E either call me if there's an issue. I can be your backup. But usually, it's not that hard to get the basic things. If it's just like, okay, we got to get an IV in pretty quick, we're going to be on the floor, and these kind of things, these are the parameters, these are the IV things that we use. Those are not that difficult, and most on-call pediatricians will accept those kind of responsibilities. But it was, and we certainly did the same thing, but there would be times when something would come up and they had not experienced it, so they would just call me, and then we would work through it. So hopefully there's some collaboration between the different docs. We know that we accept those kind of responsibilities. That's just part of the game. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And it doesn't sound like too sugar, like because one of the things you kept touching on, Dr. Nail, is the importance of communication and verbalizing and communicating and recommunicating and building that level of trust. And so it sounds like, being able to even communicate with your doctor, it's really important to me to know that you have a backup plan. Like, what's your backup plan? Or like, what have you communicated to the other doctors if I call and I need to get a CKs checked? Is that something that we can do and something that you can order? And will they freak out when they're super high or will they understand why? And being able to ask those questions, I think one of the best tips was given to me when Christopher was like 3 or 4 is that your pediatrician has the capability of being your best advocate through all of this. I think it was Alex's mom maybe that told me that. And it stuck with me because at that point I was just like you, Sharika, where I was like, I don't know. I've always used this metabolic doctor. But then I started asking the pediatrician more questions, which made them kind of in turn talk to the metabolic specialists more. And so they started naturally collaborating a little bit more, which was good because then it just built his team a little bit stronger. And so I wasn't as quite as reliant on just this like one subset. Although obviously your geneticist is a very important part of your team.
One more point I think on that too is that if you as a parent are you're going to get quite knowledgeable with all these things, and if you're prepared, you kind of know what the protocol is. That helps us to sometimes, and I'm sure I said this to some of my on-call colleagues, like, listen to Alex's mom. She knows the protocol. She can tell you what to do. Just do it. And that's because, once we've developed a level of trust, we kind of know what is going to happen in these kind of situations. We can just kind of put them into play. Now, sometimes everything can go sideways and something different comes up. Yes, okay. But for a lot of these things, they're relatively routine, minor things, but they just cause a bigger deal to these particular kids. And once we kind of know what the protocol is, we should be able to, get those kind of things implemented, even if it's not, the person you rely on the most. If the parents know their stuff, and you've got the information, you know how it goes, and you can communicate that helps. It helps us a lot. It always helped me a lot.
Right, I know the stars had another question.
So I think kind of along the same vein, first of all of this is very new to us, and a lot of what we're doing right now is very preemptive. Like we haven't had a situation, we just know that Roman has this condition, and so we're learning, we're putting the team together. You know, we have a great geneticist in Dallas, and the pediatrician that we've used for our older son has kind of all but said, I don't know what to do for you, you know? And I don't know that at this point he's very interested in learning about Roman's condition or really collaborating with us. So right now it feels like very separate teams. And this was why tonight's talk was so appealing to me, is I didn't really think that there would be a relationship between our pediatrician and our geneticist. And maybe that sounds naive, but it's kind of felt like we have this, you know, we have the team, you know, for LCHAT, and then we have a team that will do routine visits, weight checks, vaccines, you know, that kind of thing. And so I guess what I'm trying to get to is, are you accepting new patients, Dr.
Where are
Neal?
you located?
Because we're in DFW.
Well, funny you should ask, I guess. Yeah, I'm in Dallas. I'm in North Dallas, near Medical City Hospital. So, but yeah, I mean, I'll be straight up front with you. I'm been practicing pediatrics for over 40 years, so I'm not planning on retiring, but I'm old enough to retire. I sold my practice to my younger partner, and so yeah, but I work there half time, and she's there half time. But I the reason I went into this relationship is I'm so confident of this other person. But so yeah, I if if yeah, if you're well, if you, I guess if that's a question, yeah, we our practice is still open, yeah, and we could possibly help you. But this was not a, I was not expecting soliciting business on
It's
that.
okay. These things come up naturally, you know, like it's and it's important, you know, it's important, like you said, to have these conversations with your pediatrician, because, you know, part of how sometimes that happens is networking in our community of like who else has seen other LCHAT or MCAD patients. And sometimes that question, like if you live close for us, it came up with our geneticist, because the first pediatrician, we were new parents, we didn't have any experience with like having a pediatrician or what makes a good pediatrician. But we knew, like, it seemed like she didn't seem to care. Like the first pediatrician we ever had, I was like, she was like, I'll be fine, it's no big deal. Like, and she was just so nonchalant that we felt uncomfortable, because sometimes it's hard to know, like, okay, am I just uncomfortable because I don't really know this person yet and we haven't developed a bond? And then but then I took that information back to the geneticist and I was like, this just makes me uncomfortable. And they had a list of, we happen to live in the city of Atlanta. Oh, well, all of our genetics patients we actually send here. And we lived close enough that we could go there. And that's how we ended up at the other space that we ended up with. But it's a little trickier when you live outside of those limits and are a little farther away, trying to decide, okay, maybe it's a conversation with a pediatrician of like, is this something that you want to do or not? When we moved up to Pennsylvania, a more rural area, when we started interviewing pediatricians, that was the first question I asked. I said, we have a child who's medically complex. I will not be offended. Like, is this something that you're willing to be an adventure with us on or not? And we had a couple people say, we're a little bit busy. And I'm like, thank you, I appreciate your honesty. And then we moved on to the next person. It's a hard question to ask, but I think it's helpful if both people can just be very blunt about it, you know. I don't know if you have any other thoughts, Dr. Nail, about.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you were to come to the office and just us talk, it would have to be we'd have to start on ground zero and have the conversation with myself, my colleagues, because from the time, I mean, Alex is what 21, 2,
22.
22. So we've been doing this for a long time, and a lot of things have changed. So like I said, my office has changed slightly in terms of personnel. The office that's just down the hall that I share a call with, that has also changed. So it would be a matter of I'd have to have those conversations with everybody else involved. I'd have to start, talking again to the primary hospital that we use in Dallas as Medical City. But it has changed as an institution too. So I'd have to find out, are all the things in place so that we can adequately deal, with those kind of situations when, Roman hasn't eaten in, 4 hours or whatever it is. It's like, okay, we need to deal with this. And, can we get them into the emergency room? Can we get an IV in quickly or on the floor or whatever it needs to be? And we have to have those conversations. I mean, Dallas is a big place. Unfortunately, we have a number of major institutions. Big institutions have lots of facilities and things like that, but they also are, I've found that they can be challenging to make any changes. So if the things are not in place that we really need in order to make some of those changes, sometimes it's quite difficult, I've found. And so rattling some cages or talking to some people, and which I'm very willing to do, to advocate for patients for what we need to do. But I have my other besides Alex, I've got an NCAD kid in my practice, which usually is milder, but sometimes the same things come up. And that with that family, they did not have very good experiences, with that, with the hospital across the street from us. There are a couple of ER visits that really didn't go well. They were not given adequate attention, and we had to change. It was just like, we just, so I'm not wedded to a particular institution if they're not taking care of my patients. So like, okay, let's find something better.
I see Shrika's hand. Shrika, I'm going to get to you in a second, but a question came in, and I feel like it kind of goes with what you're talking about. How do you partner with the metabolic geneticist, and so as to like do the dance of not stepping on each other's toes? And how do you see patients encouraging, being able to encourage that, or how does that work?
Sometimes it's challenging. I mean, if you haven't heard this before, I'll just admit it. I mean, doctors frequently have big egos, and so we just it's sad, but sometimes when we don't know something, we don't admit it. Sometimes when people say, "I want a second opinion," they get offended. And I think that's just a human, thing that is part of it. But I guess if it's something you can just kind of work with and accept it, fine. And just you deal with the best you can. But if it's interfering with your child's care, then I think you have to sort of say, well, maybe there's a better person or a better way to do it. I mean, I don't know if it's experience or maybe just personality. I've always been open to saying, yeah, if you want a second opinion, someone who can teach me how to do this better, absolutely. Because if this is about taking care of the patient, then we're on the same team here. Let's collaborate. We should not get our egos in the way of taking care of patients ever, in my opinion. But it sometimes does. Between specialists, I mean, that's a challenge. I mean, hopefully your pediatrician, has specialists that they can lean on or call. I think with the metabolic people, we've had some good experiences and some not good experiences. Sometimes even in the same institution. And it is a challenge, but, I mean, we did still use, we have UT Southwestern here in Dallas, which is a great institution, but a couple of occasions, we kind of reached the limit, I think, to what they could actually help us with. And that's why we ended up going to Pittsburgh. And I think we still, to some degree, use some of both. And that seemed to be okay. I don't think anybody, I didn't get any feedback that anybody was mad at me for using someone in Houston for ophthalmology or Pittsburgh for metabolics or whatever. But I honestly don't care if they don't like what I'm doing. If I'm doing it the best job I can for the patient, then yeah, that's what I'm there for.
Well, thank you. And I know that's a hard question, but I feel like you tackled it very well. Sharika, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. My question is more so targeted to ER visits. We've consistently had problems with ER docs, even reading our emergency protocol letter, kind of taking our, I don't know if you'd say guidance, but following the protocol, even when sometimes our metabolic doctors will call ahead. So my question is, do you find that ER doctors, do you think that they would be more open to pediatricians calling ahead, or us having to call the pediatrician versus the specialist? I don't know if there's this idea that, like, oh, there's a specialist, so all the parents think that there's some, I don't know, like it's gets them gets us some pass or something for different care. I don't know, or if them knowing that there's a specialist involved will help them to see how serious it is. I don't know, because again, we've always leaned in our metabolic team, especially when it's come to hospital stays in the ER. But I'm wondering if it would maybe help to disarm the ER docs to have the pediatrician call or be the one that's more involved in the care, at least in the beginning.
I would say sometimes. I wish I could say it's consistent. I mean, we did that, and sometimes we received really good, excellent care, and sometimes we didn't. Like I said,
Okay.
that happened with my MCAD kid, the same institution that Alex had been. So sometimes it depends on the individual physician. Sometimes it depends on like how busy they happen to be at the time. And, they've got like their trauma room going, and all kind of things. Ideally, if you have an emergency room that actually has like pediatric emergency room is better. They tend to be a little more sensitive to pediatric problems and would probably take a call from a pediatrician or even if the pediatrician can call the charge nurse at the emergency room who kind of gets a better understanding. But yeah, so having the letter, but we've had patients, give them the letter, and it almost looked like they ignored it.
Yeah, we've
Yeah,
had that.
and it's vitally frustrating to us as well as the patients. All we can do is keep trying, or if we just keep meeting barriers, then we say, well, I know it's farther to go, but we're going to have to try to see if we can work something out at a different hospital. So we try to communicate with a different institution to say, can you accommodate this kind of thing for this kind of patient? And hopefully they can, but it's a challenge.
Dr. Neal, can you speak to direct admits and what it takes to be a direct admit? Like, is that kind of the power of the pediatrician who has a connection with the hospital? What if you don't have like direct admit privileges as a pediatrician? How does that affect your ability? And what does direct admit mean? Because there might be some people that are listening to this that don't know what direct admit means.
Yeah, direct admit means generally it's it might differ from hospital to hospital, but generally it's going to mean that your pediatrician has hospital privileges at the hospital. So in order for me to admit and take care of patients, I have to be on staff. I have to have requested all of the responsibilities that would entail taking care of a patient on the floor. And the hospital committee has to approve all those things that I have the necessary qualifications and experience to do those things. So if I've done all those things, then I can direct admit. So yeah, I could with Alex. Yeah, most of mine were direct admits if we could, but she still needed the IV sometimes, and so sometimes it would look like, well, we're going to have to go to the ER first to try to get the line in and those kind of things, because if the floor didn't have the team available or something like that to get the line in or something, we had to go through the ER. So there was it's a combination of things. So but the pediatrician would have to have actually admission privileges. So, for instance, I'm still on the clinical faculty at Children's Medical Center at UT Southwestern, but I did away with my privileges to actually admit. It's too much of a pain. It's not close to the office. I just don't need to do that. And they have good coverage. They do have, residents, and they've got lots of docs that are all pediatric oriented. And they've got specialists there. They've got the metabolic people there. It's just not necessary for me to, maintain privileges at a different institution. So it just depends on, the doctor, where they have privileges and what kind of privileges they have to actually take care of patients. Does that answer your question?
This starts to have a question because you had your hand raised there for a moment. Or you're good.
I did, but I think he answered it. I mean, I was just going to ask you from your experience, because you've obviously had this long track record with Alex and learning curve. As we shop pediatricians, we can talk to you offline about, that possibility. But as we shop, because ours has been in practice longer than you have, so I'll just say that. So, if he's not our long-term team, and we look, what is something that you would tell a pediatrician or even a parent, because in essence we have to be our own advocates, that you didn't know in the beginning, like in your learning process of this whole experience? I have gotten a lot from you that you really have to have that bond with the patient and listen to what they're going through. Outside of that, is there anything that you could give a point or two that you would have told your earlier self 20 years ago?
But I think a lot of it was stated in the question to ask the pediatrician, are you willing to, because pediatricians, one of our most valuable things is time, and special needs children take more time. And it's more work, it's more, but and some docs are just don't are not either able to or not willing to take on the extra responsibility that entails. And so you have to ask those kind of questions and say, yeah, this is difficult, and it takes more time, and we're going to take more time. And do you have direct admit? Can you facilitate those kind of things for this? Are you willing to get up to speed on these kind of patients? Because that, I mean, I certainly did. It was just like, okay, I gotta call other people, I gotta read up on it again, get the current information as best I can, and be willing to advocate for your patient. So yeah, I guess you just have to ask and say, yeah, is this something that you're able and willing to do?
Appreciate that.
That help?
Thank you. Absolutely.
And I think, like, as it all gets back to how much you've emphasized the importance of verbalizing and communicating, because as it is like such a partnership, because every human being has such a different personalities, right? And like what one family needs and other family might tackle differently. And so figuring out and being able to verbalize, like, this is what I need, or this is, or I like how in your presentation, Dr. Nail, you mentioned, if you can be direct about what your goal is, what your hope is. There's such a short window of time to become super close with your pediatrician or individual. So there's a lot of pressure there, like I think on both sides. And I think, for us, being able to have a pediatrician for a long time, like they quickly realized that we were going to be that patient that was going to bring them medical journal articles, like, here you go. Like, are you okay with that? And if you're not okay with that, and being able to have that conversation, because in my mind as a parent, I'm like, at the time he was their first, I think, fatty acid oxidation disorder, period. So it was kind of like, so I knew, like, okay, you have all these patients. I'm going to be reading the literature because that's how I deal with my anxiety about everything. Like, I can do that. Will you accept it if I do that? And, if the answer is no, then it wasn't a good fit, so.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I'm always excited for, I mean, I can learn from patients. I mean, because we got these parents who are highly motivated to learn about how to best take care of their kiddo, and they're also sometimes just scared spitless too. So they're trying to figure it out, and if they find stuff that's relevant for their care, And part of it too is for us to help you filter through some of the information, because there's good information and then there's not so good information. And that's sometimes the challenge to figure out between, the parents and the pediatrician, is this really relevant or is this really a good study? I mean, it's a paper because this guy wanted to write a paper, but it's based on two patients. I'm not sure that really applies to, and it wasn't the exact diagnosis or something like, you get the gist that sometimes stuff, looks promising but may not be, or it may, but please, I would say do that, and hopefully you have a pediatrician who's willing to, look at that information. And I ask parents, like, yeah, bring me stuff, absolutely. If you find something that, because oftentimes they have more time than I do to do that kind of research. And if you can help me out, let's do it. Yeah.
Well, and it's like a point too, because in this day of it's the information age, right? Like, journal articles are great and are important, but a lot of people are getting information in a variety of different sources. And so it's always a good idea to take the information to your doctor so they can help you figure out what is legit, especially if you've read something on Facebook, or heard it from another parent. I always encourage people, even in our support calls, like people give amazing advice, and I always remind people and take that back to your doctor and make sure that, this sounds right for you and your family. Because it's really important too that everybody stays on the same page, There was a question that came in that asked, how do you see your role as a patient moves on to adulthood? Are there any things that can make the transition smooth from pediatric care to adult care?
I should probably ask Alex to give the answer to that, and she could certainly help with this. It is a challenge because, adult care, with a internal medicine doctor, there just aren't going to be that many physicians who have the familiarity with some of these types of diseases because they're mostly childhood diseases, and so they're going to have to be willing to accept some of those same kind of things, like getting up to speed and figuring out, is this something that they can handle. It's also more challenging, I think, for internal medicine because they're often geared differently from pediatrics. And pediatrics, we keep our probably half of our schedule open in any given day because we know that we got sick kids that are going to call in because I got sick the night before. And so we can see them that day. Internal medicine hardly ever does that. I mean, you call into an internal medicine doctor and you're sick, and I say, we'll see you in like 3 days or 4 days. You can't do that with an LCHAP person. So, how are they going to handle that? I mean, that's it. Well, it's just, trying to find some of those people, it's hard, but that sometimes that means you're still seeing them in their 20s, to some degree. Or when Alex went off to college, I got phone calls from the docs up there to say, what do we do with this kid? And so we worked through it, and they got educated, and we worked it out. One other point, when you were talking a minute ago about you're going to network with other parents and getting information. I would say you be open but cautious, and learn to ask the question, wow, that's an interesting point. Do you have ask them for the article that they got it from? Most of the time, most of the time they don't have it. It's kind of hearsay stuff, and it just and that's a big challenge for us as pediatricians, is patients will come in for this stuff that they just heard from, on social media, and I don't know what to do with it most of the time. It's like, well, I think you're gonna have to go back and ask them, what their source is, because if it's a reliable source that I really need to pay attention to, okay, let's talk about it. But if it's just, junk, that's out there, and there is so much junk out there, I got to move on, and I'm not going to pay attention to something that is just someone said something that hurt it from somebody, and it cured their problem. Like, okay, you're gonna have to show me more, because I can't do much with information that doesn't, have any substance to it.
That's a very valid point. So we're hitting the 8:15. We're heading into, but I'm curious if there are any last questions for Dr. Nail. So I'm gonna hit the record button off, and we'll give a chance to in case there's questions that people don't want to be recorded. But I do want to thank everybody who's joined us tonight or today, if you're on the West Coast, or if you're watching this recording after session. If you have more questions, please feel free to reach out to me at sharry, Harry, mitoaction.org, and we'll try to help find some answers for your questions and make sure that you get plugged in and get connected. And stay tuned. We hope that you come to another Evening Expert series. So I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. Oh.